before we get there. And when we get there, we find out either it didn't happen like we thought it was going to, or either it's not nearly so bad as we thought it might be. That's one of the neat things, at least for me, about getting older. You know, you notice that I said getting older and not getting old. There's a difference between those two. But and quite honestly, I see more advantages than I do disadvantages. It's taken lots of pressure off of my life as I get older. 30 years ago, I didn't understand that, but maybe some of you will. I'm not nearly as concerned about how I look now as I was 30 years ago. After all, there's only so much you can do anyway, right? But I'm not nearly as concerned about what people think about me. And I'm saying all of these things and others, it takes a lot of pressure off of your life. I don't have to prove anything to anybody anymore. Used to, I had lots of things to prove. I can admit that I'm not as good at some things as others are. As a matter of fact, I'm not the best at anything. And that's okay. It really is okay. In fact, I'm happier now than I was when I was young. And young people, I want you to know that. That if you make right decisions in your life, and I'm not holding myself up as the epitome of having made all right decisions, but I'm saying if you basically make wise, right decisions early in your life, then your life will get progressively better. The Lord designed it that way. And that's a really neat thing. Certainly there are disadvantages, but we're not going to talk about those. In view of the advantages, I think they're small. But there is something that makes me sad about this process, and that is the world that I grew up in doesn't exist anymore. I don't mean to imply that the world at that time was perfect. In fact, far, far from it. Maybe the 60s was the worst decade, may prove to be the worst decade ever for our country. But nevertheless, there were some things about that time, the time that I grew up, that I do miss. That time was filled with pressures and fears and wars and injustices and sin, just like today is. In fact, probably most of you here can't relate to when you were in school that you had bomb drills, where whenever a horn went off, you got up under your desk. Now you think about what that would do to your child, and how you live with that fear during the Cold War, what we call the Cold War. It felt pretty hot to me whenever we were doing that kind of thing. But the world, it was a world where immorality was not generally approved. It was a world where it was not flaunted and applauded. It was a world where you didn't have two of the most popular people in our society who, like animals, decided they were going to breed and have a baby and the whole world's happy about it and trying to fight to get pictures of them. That makes a difference. It's not that things are so much worse. It's that public attitude about how things are. I've had people ask me why Janice and I sacrificed and saved and spent money to send our girls to a Christian college. They say, don't you know that everything that you see in the world is present in a Christian college? And my answer is yes, I do know that. But you see, there is a difference. It's not approved. And that's a major difference. It is a significant difference. There's about a year and a half ago, and by the way, I have gotten kind of attached to Richard Justice columns in the paper. One of the first things I flipped to read to see if he has an editorial there in the sports section, and I enjoy reading that. Now, if it's kind of the politics of it, I don't understand it, but whenever it's someone that he's highlighting or a person, then I really do enjoy reading about that. But there's a a little college in the Ozark Mountains, a Presbyterian college called the College of the Ozarks, just about 40 miles south of Springfield, Missouri, that about 2 years ago, as a matter of fact, they had a national championship basketball squad. And four of the outstanding stars on that basketball squad were suspended for drinking off campus. And the Springfield Register picked up the Springfield News Leader picked that story up and had an editorial about it because there was quite a stir about the coach kicking these four outstanding athletes off of that squad. And as you would imagine, there was lots of disapproval of the coach. And just a few, to go down through this article in the Springfield News Leader, let me just read a little bit. It's easy to understand the reaction of one parent to news that the College of the Ozarks near Branson suspended four members of its national championship basketball squad for drinking at an off-campus party. The students didn't break the law. No charges were filed. They weren't on the campus of a private Christian school when they were drinking. As one of the suspended players' father said, "My concern is that it's supposed to be a Christian university, but it's certainly not showing any mercy." He has a point when he argues his son and others deserve a second chance, but as we look at the College of the Ozarks suspension, we see something else: integrity, fairness, putting rules ahead of athletic glory. All too often in the big money world of athletics, the story of student athletes breaking the rules has quite a different ending. And I'm skipping down through the article. What the suspensions of several key athletes does tell us is that at the College of the Ozarks, rules are rules. There are not different rules for different athletes. Everybody is treated the same. Other colleges and universities could learn from that example. We don't think the university is so naive as to think that its students don't occasionally break the rules. But its history is one that says when rules violations are found out, the hammer comes down without fear or favor to a student's time in the 40-yard dash. What we do know is that the university decided its integrity was more important than wins and losses to the basketball court. That's a lesson that will be remembered much longer than any championship banner. You know, I can't stop all of the immorality in the world, but I can stand against it. I feel the pressure of that more today than I've ever felt it before. And I'm sure that this comes out in some of my lessons, and I don't apologize for that. I have favorite illustrations, just like most speakers do. And I hate to use them because once you've used them, you use them. You know what I'm saying? You don't have it in the bank anymore. But one of my very favorite illustrations that I've ever heard is a story of a little boy and his dad who lived in the city, and they were hurrying to catch the bus at a bus stop. And when they rounded the corner and about a block and a half away, they could see the bus, and the last passengers were getting on the bus that they wanted to catch. And the dad reached down and grabbed his little boy's hand, and he said, "Son, let's run." And he said, "Dad, we'll never make it." And he looked at his son and he said, "Son, you're probably right, but let's miss it running." Now that means something to me in my life. I can't change everything in the world. I can't accomplish all the things that I would like to accomplish. But one thing I can do, I can miss it running. I can fight battles that I know that I'm not going to win, at least not from a worldly standpoint. And I'm afraid that too many of us have simply accepted the immorality in our society as inevitable, and our answer to it has become tolerance. We just tolerate it. Dave Short recently taught us outstanding lessons from the book of Jeremiah. And it was like reading the newspaper. And the message is still the same. Jeremiah chapter 8, beginning in verse 8. "How can you say we are wise and the law of the Lord is with us? Behold, the lying pen of the scribes has made it into a lie. The wise men are put to shame. They're dismayed and caught. Behold, they have rejected the word of the Lord. And what kind of wisdom do they have? They heal the brokenness of the daughter of my people superficially by saying, peace, peace, when there is no peace. Preaching a positive message is not always the answer. Making the message fit the culture is not the answer. I'm reminded everywhere that I go that Christianity is counterculture. Everywhere it is, in every single culture. There is no culture that man has ever had that Christianity does not fly in the face of it. I grew up with the notion, mistaken or not, that we lived in a Christian nation. And we Christians have long assumed that America is a Christian nation, but at some point, we're going to have to realize that we're not a Christian nation. And if that hasn't soaked in on you yet, you probably need to let it soak in. If we ever were, there's pretty convincing evidence that we no longer are. I mean, with the push to get God out of almost everywhere, including money and every public place, removing the Ten Commandments from public places, being entertained by immorality, a plague of pornography and homosexuality. If we ever did operate under the assumption that we were a Christian nation, then that's being taken away. I'm reminded of the people during Jeremiah's time, and this is the sermon that he preached to them in Jeremiah 7. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, do not trust in deceptive words, saying, this is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. Behold, you're trusting in deceptive words to no avail. But go now to my place which was in Shiloh, where I made my name dwell at the first. And by the way, if you don't know the history of the Old Testament of Shiloh, then this is going to go over your head. But Shiloh was the place where the Ark of the Covenant was, and God had it utterly destroyed. And see what I did to it because of the wickedness of my people. Do you not see what they're doing in the cities of Judah and the streets of Jerusalem? Do they spite me? I spoke to you rising up early and speaking, but you did not hear. I called to you, but you did not answer. And then God says to Jeremiah, and you shall speak all these words to them, but they will not listen to you. You will call to them, but they will not answer. They trusted in the fact that the temple was still standing and that they went there and they offered their sacrifices and their burnt offerings and they made their contributions. And you know what? It wasn't very long after this that God took that temple out so that it wasn't there anymore. Listen to what the Lord told the people of Jeremiah's day. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, add your burnt offerings to your sacrifices and eat flesh. He said, don't waste your good animal meat by making a sacrifice to me because I know what your heart is. Just eat it yourself. For I did not speak to your fathers or command them in the day I brought them out of the land of Egypt concerning burnt offerings and sacrifices. But this is what I commanded them. Obey my voice, and I will be your God, and you will be my people. And you will walk in all the ways which I command you, that it may be well with you. Yet they did not incline their ear, but they walked in their own counsels, in the stubbornness of their evil heart, and went backward and not forward. How many of us, there's an application to be made. How many of us trust in the fact that we come to church, and we partake of the Lord's Supper, and we give some money, and we make this sacrifice, and then we go out and do our own thing? Has it come to the point that we believe that the Old Testament, the order of the day was to obey God? And the order of today is, well, God is a God of mercy and grace, and so we can just kind of do whatever we want to. Isn't it interesting how we can be objective with the shortcomings and sins of others, but somehow it's just not the same when I do it? You notice that? Let me give you a quick spiritual thermometer that I want you to take your spiritual temperature. The passage that was read a little earlier, 2 Peter. Turn there if you would. I know it's not the kind of passage that you normally see used today. We kind of ignore passages like this anymore because they're not very pleasant. And they talk about things that people don't like to talk about. They never have. And in the first three verses, the setting is that there's going to be false teachers among God's people. And he says in verse 3, he says, their condemnation has long been hanging over them and their destruction has not been sleeping. In other words, because they haven't been punished, because you witnessed them and they seem to be prospering, he says, don't fool yourself into thinking that the day is not coming, because it's coming. For if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but sent them to hell, putting them in gloomy dungeons to be held for judgment, if he did not spare the ancient world when he brought the flood on its ungodly people, but protected Noah, a preacher of righteousness, and seven others, if he condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah by burning them to ashes and made them an example of what's going to happen to the ungodly, and if he rescued Lot, a righteous man who was distressed by the filthy lives of lawless men, for that righteous man living among them day after day was tormented by the lawless deeds he saw and heard. If that's so, then the Lord knows how to rescue godly men from trials and how to hold the unrighteous for the day of judgment while continuing their punishment. Peter's warning God's church about these false prophets and teachers who love to tell stories to introduce false doctrines. And then in verse 4 through 10, he has 2 points. The first one is to demonstrate God's ability to punish. He uses 3 illustrations. First of all, angels who sinned. Secondly, people during the time of the flood. And thirdly, Sodom and Gomorrah. And when you get through thinking about those 3 incidences, angels who sinned, which we don't know much about, but he cast them down, it says, into dark dungeons, dark pits to be held. And secondly, we know something more about the people during the time of the flood. And then thirdly, we know something about Sodom and Gomorrah. And he uses those 3 illustrations. When you get through thinking about those 3, run those through your mind, then ask yourself the question, does God know how to punish the guilty? Does God do a pretty good job of punishing the guilty? And by the way, you might connect another verse there. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord, I will repay. Let God take care of vengeance. By the way, he can do a lot better job than you can of punishing. You have only a limited power of what you can do, but God is pretty good about punishing when he punishes, isn't he? And then the second thing is God demonstrates his ability to rescue those in distress. During the days of the flood, God protected Noah, it says. And then during the destruction of the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, God rescued Lot. And so this was 2 incidences that happened in the world that if you were alive, you couldn't do anything to help yourself. The flood, or if you were in the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, there wasn't anything you could do to help yourself. But God is capable of rescuing you regardless of the circumstances. When it's completely out of your control, then God can get you out of that. And he's demonstrated that. So here's the 2 points here. God knows how to punish and God knows how to preserve and how to rescue and how to protect. Now, here's my question. And look at these incidences about Noah and Lot, particularly. Is God aware of even one single person on the face of this whole earth who's faithful to him? And will he take care of them? And the answer is yes and yes. Now, I want to draw your attention for just a moment of what the text says there was about Lot that pleased God. Look at verse 7 and 8. Lot, a righteous man, if he rescued Lot, a righteous man, who was distressed by the filthy lives of lawless men, And then he explains, "For that righteous man living among them day after day was tormented by the lawless deeds that he saw and heard." He was distressed and he was tormented about the society in which he lived. And God was aware of that, and it pleased God. God took note of that. He didn't just say, "I'll go along." He didn't just become tolerant of that society. Think about this for a moment. God is pleased that you are distressed and tormented about sin. How do you truly feel about sin? I mean, in your heart of hearts. That's why I said this is a spiritual thermometer here. How do you truly feel about sin in your heart of hearts? And I'm telling you, when you live in a society that becomes more and more tolerant and approving of sin, it's hard. It's really hard to take a stand against sin. But God's people do. And God's people always will. How does your thermometer read? Are you a light under a basket? Have you allowed yourself to be influenced by society and lost your spiritual fervor? Do you just go along to get along? You find that the easiest way to survive in society? Christianity is counterculture in every culture that's ever existed, even in America. And if we're not willing to live that way, we cannot be His disciple. It's okay to be different, young folks. In fact, it's required. It's necessary that we be different. And if we think we've made friends with a lion, we're sadly mistaken. Because he'll eat you alive. He might let you pet him for a little while. But he will turn. And he will consume you. Are we abusing God's grace and long-suffering nature by participating in things that are sinful in our lives? Have we just decided that tolerance is the best answer? You see, tolerance is just a politically correct way of giving up to sin. Are you being light to your family and your friends and this community? Can people look at you and measure their life by you? Can people follow you in what you're doing and how you're living and how you conduct yourself? Christianity is not so much about what you accomplish in this life as it is what you become. And right now, are you growing closer to God? Are you closer to Him and following His word than you were 5 years ago in your life? Are you the kind of example that you want your children to follow and your neighbors to follow? You see, because you're a light. And you don't put a bushel basket over a light. It's meant to give light to those in darkness. While we stand and sing.